Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love, coming to you wherever you may be. Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where our guest today is Melanie Benjamin, an author whose career I've been following since her debut novel, Alice I Have Been. In fact, she was one of our first Book Reporter Talks To guests in July 2019. Today, we're going to be talking about her historical fiction, The Children's Blizzard. And once again, she's written a Book Reporter Bets On selection. Melanie, welcome. It's so nice to see you.
Oh, it's wonderful to see you, Carol. Wish we could be in person, obviously. But yeah, it's just, I'm privileged. I'm thankful to everything you've done for me and my books over the last 11 years. I can't believe it's been 11 years. And
it's 11 years. Oh my God. But we haven't aged at all. We haven't aged
at all. No, seven books. This is my seventh book in 11 years. It's just kind of insane.
Wow.
I know. It's crazy.
Yeah, it completely is.
And wait a minute.
Oh, you know that.
Okay.
Hold the book.
Way back behind me.
Way back behind you.
Yeah.
Well, the events in this book took place on January 12th, 1888, which is 133 years ago today. Like, it's just absolutely crazy. And I love that your pub day matched up to this. Was there a lot of discussion about that?
None at all. And I don't think anybody realized. You know, pub dates changed several, it was originally like February, and then we looked at the calendar and we saw some other books coming out, so then we moved it to January, but it was like next week or the week after the inauguration. Like, the inauguration was a thing everyone was trying to kind of deal with, and finally they said January 12th, and I was like, okay, great. And then like 2 weeks later, I went, wow, that's the actual date of the blizzard. And I sent an email to everyone. I said, did you guys know that that's the actual anniversary of the blizzard? And nobody had figured it out. It was not the reason they changed the pub date. Just one of those happy.
I love it. It was just kismet.
Yeah.
It's so funny because you could have sat there and completely planned this. And it's like, no, that's not a good week. Instead, you fell into it.
Right. Well, you know how it's been this year with the election and then the inauguration. There's so many things people, and the pandemic, and there's been so many reasons for people to have to move books that were supposed to come out last spring into this year. And so there was a lot of shuffling and jockeying and things to avoid on the calendar. So yeah, this was just absolutely by accident.
Complete kismet. Well, you know, it's really funny. There was somebody who sent me a book January or February that was coming out in May. And he said, could you read it? And I just didn't get to it. I'm like, thank God, because it's not coming out till this June. I remember what the books are about, but that'd be tough.
People, readers really quite understand what the pandemic did to books and schedules and authors having to wait like an extra year to have their book out. It's been really tough. Yeah.
It's been a huge jockey. Mm-hmm. So what drew you to write the story of the Children's Blizzard?
I never want to write the same book twice. That is a big thing about me. And I really did feel that I needed to move in a bit of a different direction with my historical novels that had previously been all about real women, basically, and following kind of like one person's life or at least a portion of her life. And I felt I needed to do something different. I still love historical fiction. I can't see myself ever not writing something historical. So I thought, well, let's this look at a real event that happened that maybe people don't really know about and construct a novel around that. And as I was thinking and planning, the Children's Blizzard is an actual blizzard that occurred on January 12th, 1888 in the Great Plains. I knew the name of it. I knew vaguely, obviously it was a tragedy, a weather disaster. And then I started looking at it and, I just thought this is the book I need to write. I wanted to write a big saga, a kind of a thrilling story, a survival against the elements. I wanted a big story with all the emotions. And as I researched and discovered all the background, which I'm sure we'll go into about the school teachers and the immigrants to that period, what had happened obviously to the Native Americans and weather and how you couldn't really predict it then and how harsh it was to those immigrants. I just thought this is the story I need to write. I just And I read some of the oral histories of some of the survivors to get some stories of those who were caught up in the storm. And a couple of the characters are kind of based on mm-hmm. some of the actual people. And then there are some that are entirely made up.
Yeah. Speaking of that, the story's framed against the lives of these two school teachers, really. They're like, you know, at the heart of the book. Yeah. They were both school teachers in these very rural schools. They were also very young. They were not, you know, this is not seasoned people. What drew you to write from their perspectives?
I think when I was researching this novel, and just to sum up, and on the morning afternoon of January 12th, 1888, a day that had dawned surprisingly warm for the Great Plains during this period known as the Little Ice Age, children went to school for the first time in weeks because the weather had been so brutal before then. And this actual blizzard that struck around the time school was letting out is known to history as the children's blizzard or the schoolhouse blizzard, because so many of the victims were children, not just the pupils. And this is what fascinated me, but even the school teachers were young women, 15, 16 years old, barely out of the classroom themselves, who had to make life and death decisions in an instant. You know, do they let the children go and try to outrun the storm? Or do they keep them inside and risk freezing to death and wait for rescue? So I decided to, that idea that the school teachers in charge of these pupils' lives in a very tough environment had to make these decisions, and they were only 15 or 16 year old girls, mm-hmm. you know, boarding away from home, perhaps for the first time. That really, really resonated with me. So that's how I decided to tell the story primarily of two sisters boarding in different school districts, who make very, very different decisions in that terrifying moment, mm-hmm. and how the impact of those decisions affect them and the students in their charge for the rest of their lives. So that's why I really wanted to concentrate on these two sisters. And it is an immigrant story, obviously. Northern European immigrants made up a lot of the homesteaders during this period. And they're immigrants. Their parents came over when they were very, very young. And that was very, very typical of the people settling the areas like Nebraska and the Dakota Territory.
Yeah, because this is not just a story of the storm, but it's also of those who settled these territories. They were somewhat sold a bill of goods about the land. Like, you know, go west.
There was fake news. I mean, that again attracted me, that there were these fake news stories planted in these Northern European newspapers calling the Great Plains, which is an inland desert at the time, this kind of wonderful place where everything will grow and everything is mild and the weather is perfect. And you know, this is the era of these blizzards and grasshoppers falling from the sky and prairie fires and drought, and it was horrible. And so, yeah, that really intrigued me. Sorry to interrupt.
You were raised in the Midwest. Did you know about all these stories when you were growing up? Like, had you heard of what was happening on the plains, the way people were migrating west, but also about the blizzards? Had you heard about that?
No, I mean, this is another reason why the story is very personal to me, though, because my mother's family came over from Germany, from both sides of her family tree, came over to Germany, but they came over about in the 1870s, I think, and settled in Illinois and Indiana. So they weren't upper Midwest, they were just Midwest. And yet, so I didn't know those stories, but yet certainly I knew these people, mm-hmm. These generations and generations of children tied to the land because of an impulsive decision by their parents to leave home and come here under false pretenses. And, you know, more of them left and went back home in those years than stayed. And I'm not sure we recall that about the whole kind of great migration, you know, the manifest destiny kind of thing of this country. We don't really recall how harsh the conditions were and that people left to go home because it was so hard. So no, I didn't have stories of this blizzard, but yet as I'm writing the novel, I did recall, you know, they're, I do know these people. You know, they're good people, they're hardworking people, they're stoic people. they don't ask too much of life. And that's what I was really interested in showing, the perspective of one of the heroines who kind of maybe does ask more than she's supposed to and sees that kind of as her punishment forever. So yeah, I actually named some of the characters after my relatives. My grandparents are in there, for example.
I love it. You know, you open the book with a note from the Signal office, which I take is how they did weather predicting during those days. So were those forecasts shared? I mean, I picture, wait, well, look, nobody was texting or calling each other on the phone. How no. did you get the weather besides looking up at the sky?
Yeah, that is, I didn't go into a lot of that in my novel. There is an excellent nonfiction book about the blizzard where it's a lot more about that. But basically, there was no National Weather Service yet in those days, right? There was the Army Signal Corps was in charge of what they called weather indicating. They didn't even call it forecasting. And right before the blizzard, there was one office, one major office in Washington, D.C., but they had all these stations throughout the West, at Army forts, at railroad stations and cities, where they had, you know, Army, members of the Army, Army people, taking indications like temperature and what the wind was and barometric pressure at several times a day. And then they would telegraph those findings back to Washington, where they would map it out and then telegraph their indication for that time period back out to the telegraph stations and the railroad stations and the newspapers in the West. And of course, by the time it got to anywhere, the weather had already blown through. So they had just recently opened up an office in St. Paul to kind of try to maybe get a little quicker kind of indication for the West. The railroads really needed it. The railroads made the West, and they were hammered by the unpredictable weather of the Great Plains. But the problem was that there was a lot of corruption. There were the indications themselves were not always reliable. The information that people would telegraph to the main office, sometimes people would pay somebody to do it for them while they went off fishing, or they'd manufacture a week's worth of readings so they didn't actually have to work and then pay somebody to regularly send them back. And of course, most of the homesteaders, one, so many of them didn't speak English, so they didn't take English language papers, so they wouldn't have read the indications. And they were so far away, the only way they could indicate the weather were, there were a series of flags they would raise over generally railroad stations in these small settlements. But most people were not within view of them. So that was the beginning, and the Army Signal Corps did not see the blizzard coming. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't indicate the what they called a cold wave indication. It was kind of like the most severe weather coming in the winter. They didn't do that in time for the blizzard, but I don't think it would have mattered if they had.
Mm-hmm. No, it was... It was like the people were doomed. You know, it's really interesting. I always say that the weatherman is a really powerful job. This is somebody who can say it's going to rain tomorrow and can make an entire group of people leave the house with an umbrella. And you may never need the umbrella that day, but you carried it because they told you that was going to happen. So,
you know, I just really want people to realize when they're reading this book, I get text alerts on my phone when there's severe weather, right? We all do, right? We don't take weather the same way. We don't experience weather the same way that people on the Great Plains did in those days. And because so many, Eastern weather is a completely different thing to predict than the weather on the Great Plains, which is so unpredictable because of the Rocky Mountains and the Arctic fronts coming down from Canada, meeting the Gulf air. And it was just something nobody really had any experience other than obviously the Native Americans, mm-hmm. whose land had been taken away from them. They certainly could read the weather in a different way, but for sure, all these Norwegians and Germans and Swedes coming over from a completely different environment to the Great Plains, which is about it's still Tornado Alley today. It's probably the place with the most unpredictable weather in this country. They didn't know. They didn't really know how to deal with it.
At the Garden Center, they told me to watch Small Animals, and the squirrels were going absolutely insane this summer and trying to shore up acorns.
Yeah, I've heard that if they store more acorns, it means it's a colder winter.
And there was also an acorn shortage, the things you have time to learn about during a pandemic. And there were less acorns. And we actually watched these two squirrels in the one afternoon running around like they were on speed, like running around the yard. And my husband goes, what is going on? Like they were making so much noise that we were both reading and you couldn't read because they were going around. And they said, yeah, it's got to do with the lack of acorns and therefore seeing a tough winter. So I was like, okay, squirrels, calm it down because I don't want to hear about a rough winter on top
of it. Well, so far it really hasn't been a rough winter.
It hasn't been. Yeah. So maybe it was just the acorn problem.
Yeah, maybe.
Just that. you know, I actually felt cold reading this book, and I've heard it from other readers. Were you bundled up as you wrote? I figure you wrote with a hat and glove on, and I think you use every cold word that I could come across. I think that we could just go through this book when you're reading it, folks, and just circle cold word, cold word, cold word.
You know, that was the challenge, but the delight. It's funny. This is a tragic. There is tragedy in this novel. There's no getting around it. However, there's also hope, and there's resilience and courage and love. There, you'll feel all the emotions. But I had a lot of fun writing it, which seems odd with the subject matter. But the challenge of describing this menacing storm, which is a character in the novel itself, I think parts of the book, at least for sure the first half of the book, reads like a thriller. Mm-hmm. Somebody on Goodreads described the book as Stephen King meets Little House on the Prairie. And I think that's the perfect description. So it was a challenge and a great delight to describe the blizzard and use all the words in the English language and and always come up with a different way to describe it was the real challenge, but I delighted in it. It was such a fun writing challenge, you know, a writing exercise at its purest level. And so I thank you for saying that. I was not cold while I was writing it. I did finish the book up though last October. Oftentimes when I'm nearing the end of a book and a deadline is looming, I will go off to Colorado to finish up because I write, there's something about it that just makes me write buckets. And I've done this several times, and I went up the week before Halloween, and I've done this several years and never before has it snowed that week, but there were two back-to-back major snowstorms while I was up there writing the novel in Estes Park that made me housebound. I literally could not leave the little condo that I was in the mountains in a rental car. I was kind of stuck. And so that was, I just looked at that as a good sign.
Dakota.
Yeah.
That was Dakota. Wait, okay.
Yeah.
You know, I know that you're doing a virtual tour this year, which is more difficult for, you know, an author to get used to because usually packing that bag is something exciting. But I got to tell you, with this book, I might have had my doubts about sending you on the road. I think that you could have called in storms every place you went. You
know? Well, like you said, I've heard from, even my father said that he was surprised when he was reading the book. He's 89. My dad liked the book. He doesn't always like Amon books, but he liked this one. And he said he kept when he would look up from the book out the window, he'd be surprised not to see snow coming down outside the window. So I've heard that so I think we should have, you know, included a blanket.
Mm-hmm. Optional blanket with the book. Optional blanket
of every book. I think that might have been a smart idea.
Is that little earmuffs, something like that? You know, one of your characters is a journalist named Gavin Woodson. He's sent to Omaha after a run-in with the world's Joseph Pulitzer, and he feels like he's in godforsaken Nebraska, and he's struggling with not being in New York. But he has an eye that he can tell the story, and he can personalize the story of these people. So talk to us about him as a character, because he's such a big character for so many things he influences in this book.
Yeah. So he's one of the ones that I made up out of a whole cloth. There's no actual historical reference for a Gavin Woodson. But we touched on the idea of fake news. So when these territories, after, you know, they were purchased through the Louisiana Purchase, and then during the Civil War, we really kind of began the tragic Indian Wars to take the land from the Native Americans. And there is their misery and their tragedy kind of hovers over this book. I don't ignore it. It's there. But then during the middle of the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln signed the Homesteading Act, which was the act that, you know, gave 120 acres for those who, for a filing fee, if they could stay on the land for 5 years and prove it up, usually meaning building a structure on it. And that opened up the West, what was the West then, west of the Mississippi, to people, to homesteaders. And then the railroads came. So even right after the Civil War, the Union Pacific Railroad came and it went west from Omaha. So that made Omaha explode as a town. So all of a sudden the railroads really needed people out there to turn the railroads a profit, because if they're not people there, you know, transporting themselves or their goods on the railroads, they're not going to make a profit. And then the boosters of these territories needed people. And when I say people, sadly, they meant white people, mm-hmm. to turn these territories into states. So there was a great need, and we didn't have enough white people in this country to come settle the Great Plains in the way that these boosters wanted it done and as quickly as they wanted it done. So this is where Gavin Woodson comes in. People like him were hired to write these false news stories purporting to describe the Great Plains as something it was not. And they planted these propaganda basically in newspapers, not in, like Eastern cities like New York as well, because many people who lived in tenements in New York, many of them went west, but they planted them in newspapers in countries like Norway and Germany and Sweden, Northern Europe. So Gavin is, I thought, let's follow his story, a dissipated, bitter, jaded, failed newspaper man who he feels has been reduced to, you know, writing. He's not a journalist anymore, right? He's being paid to write puff pieces. And he hates it. He looks down and with disdain at the people he describes as the rubes who believed his lies, who came out. So he starts the novel in a very bitter, jaded place. But there, a chance occurrence kind of opens his eyes to the fact that these are people, not just victims of his stupid people who swallowed his prose. And he sees in the aftermath of the blizzard, I believe, his eyes open up and he sees a chance to save some people who he may have victimized, but also to redeem himself. And his story kind of takes over the second half of the book, which is the aftermath of the storm. And a lot of it is rooted in reality. The newspapers, particularly like in Omaha, they sold a lot of copies describing all the tragedy of the blizzard, but then people get tired of reading the tragedy part. Then they had to come up with a different angle. And this is where Gavin comes in. And he kind of decides to, and I don't want to give too much away, to kind of go in a different way to tell the stories of the people who survived the storm. And in doing so, he changes the lives of these sisters and some of their pupils forever, and actually brings them opportunities they might not have had. And in the process, I think opens his heart and eyes and redeems himself. He's one of those characters that I knew he was going to be there, but his arc took me by surprise. Mm-hmm. There was a moment when I was writing the book, when I got to the second half, and I went, oh, this is what the second half of the book is about. And it was Gavin's quest. And he just really surprised me. I really liked his arc quite a lot.
One of the things that Gavin does, not going to talk about give it away. Did that actually happen?
You're too vague here.
I'm being too vague. Reward. Yes. Reward.
Yes. Yes.
Did that actually happen?
Yes. That actually happened. Yes.
I really try to give nothing away, everybody, to the point.
Yeah, no. He actually kind of made some of these school teachers media darlings. I guess we could say that. Right. And there were ramifications to that. And that really did happen. There were articles in the Omaha Daily Bee that I looked at that were all about this. And there were songs written for some of the school teachers who people kind of elevated as heroines.
Into the story. Yeah. There are places where you intersperse writing about birds and other animals in the area. Like, you'll just take a chapter and you'll sort of bring us into the world of what's going on and their reactions to the storm and what was going on, you know, like my little squirrels might've been picking up the acorns.
Exactly, yeah.
What drew you to write about them as well, to just set up place even more? I mean, I can loan you my squirrel. I mean, he can share with you.
Well, sometimes when I write, I see the movie version of my book in my head. Mm-hmm. And in my, there was always a scene and the morning after the storm, when after the storm blew through, the temperatures plunged, you know, from like 30 degrees above zero to 30 or 40 degrees below zero. And that is where a lot of the casualties occurred. People stuck out in the prairie in the midst of this storm. We haven't really talked about this storm was an incredible wall of electric clouds roaring down from the northwest, and nobody had time to do anything about it, and people were caught out, you know, unprepared. And it was so disorienting, the way the winds blew, that people got lost steps away from their home. It was really that kind of a storm. But then after the storm is when the real danger came, with the plunging temperatures. So I had a scene in my mind where I wanted to see this from the sky. I wanted to see the landscape and describe the debris, you could say, the aftermath of the storm from the sky. And then I thought, oh, a hawk. let's a hawk's eye view of the storm. And that just, I said, I'm just going to go for it, right? Mm-hmm. I'm just going to write this part from the point of view of the animals who, the hawk who sees the aftermath. And then there was a little bit before that of the animals caught in the storm as well. And I just thought, I'm just going to go for it. And I did. And nobody, like my editor was like, fine. Nobody thought it was weird. It is a book that does jump around. There's multiple point of views. There's several, we're following about six characters, three or four of them very closely, and a couple minor ones. And I thought, why not throw in some animals too?
Yeah. No, I loved it because it's also what's going on in nature while we are trying to overcome nature. And I thought that was just, well, when I get to one of those chapters, you'd be like, wait a second, there are other animals that are being affected on this besides the human animal.
Well, I didn't want to make... Yeah, I mean, this is a human story, right? There are lots of intense relationships and things going on among the people while this enormous freak of nature is happening, that they're having to battle that as well. It's a survivalist story, but then there's also a lot of personal. But then, yeah, I really just wanted to keep the pedal on the fact that this is nature. This is bigger than people. The prairies were more than the people. They overwhelmed the people, mm-hmm. and remained doing so, you know, up through the Dust Bowl and all that. And so I kept wanting to remind us that nature will always win. Mm-hmm. You know, that we're not the only people on this planet affected by it, and that it was of all the, you know, the elements of this story, you know, the people's personal stories, while they resonate with us, they were probably the smallest part of it. Mm-hmm. And I really did want to keep, you know, that sense in the novel.
It was a big overarching impact because it was the snow, but then the cold. I mean, you just picture, oh, it's not that cold today. Wear just a light sweater or wear just a light coat, go to school. Don't bring your hat. You don't need your gloves. For the one girl, don't lose your lunch bucket, don't lose your slate, don't lose these things, go off to school. This happens, snap decision of what to do. I mean, I actually was remembering a blizzard when I was in grammar school, and they actually sent us home. And they said, everyone go home. Like, very few children come to school, but we were at school. And they said, just walk home. And I remember walking home at the time we were little. So it was driving snow coming towards us. There was no school bus and you were walking home. So I was thinking of that when I read the story. I mean, believe me, we were not in harm's way. It's not like we lived that far. I also remember going home and doing eggshell art that day. The weird things that you do remember.
No day.
But we were sent home from school. I mean, you think about early dismissal, just leave. So when you leave, is it before the storm, during the storm, or after? Like, what's happening? Right. And I was also very surprised that these little one-room schoolhouses with these young 15, 16-year-old teachers, there wasn't a lot of firewood there. Like, they were talking about burning the books. Like, you know, what are we going to do?
Well, most people lived at least, you know, about half a mile or a mile away from school. So they, you know, even these kids were having, or maybe further, were having to, they tried to center the schoolhouses in these districts about like a mile, you know, hopefully that most of the homesteads were within a mile or two from it. But, you know, you're still, it's kind of a long of a walk for little kids on the prairie, no streets, no streetlights. So these districts, so that's another reason why these school teachers were so young and were all female, is the prairie school districts, unlike, say, school districts in Omaha, which were wealthier and could hire really college-educated teachers who tended to be male and then pay them more, of course. So these prairie school houses districts had no money, very little money, and usually the homesteaders themselves were building the buildings, and they didn't put a lot of money into those buildings. The children were supposed to be there to work the land. School was kind of an afterthought, right? Like, they had to send them there, but at that time the school calendar was centered around the farm calendar. So the time that they were in school was different than the times that we have now. And so they really didn't put, it was very rare to have a wooden structure because there were no trees on the prairie. They actually had to train the wood in. So that was very expensive. A lot of them were just soddies, you know, those sod houses that were actually probably better insulated than the wooden structures because they would build it, but they weren't insulated. And certainly there wasn't enough coal or enough fuel only for those few hours every day, right? So that's why the decision to keep them in was not always an easy decision, because in, they would have no idea of how long the blizzard was going to roar. They had no idea if they would have enough fuel to last, if someone would come rescue them or not. And it was so fierce that it would just, it blew out windows and roofs off of these structures. So yeah, they weren't really well prepared, even in the school. The schoolhouses were not built to shelter people. They weren't.
It wasn't. How many died that day? How many people died?
Well, we don't know. I should look this up. 200 and something was the official count.
Right.
I don't think they counted any of the Native Americans on like the Great Sioux Reservation that was took up most of South Dakota. People died months after from like frostbite. So I think a lot of people say it was could have been up to 500 or 600 people, but we just don't have an actual account. And it didn't just hit the homestead, the prairie. I mean, it certainly hits cities like Omaha. And I have a character in Omaha, a black bartender named in the novel, who we see how he and his community is left to fend for itself, really, when the blizzard hits Omaha. And it really was really important to me to show a more realistic picture of what those homesteading years were like on the prairie. Again, we have the kind of view from Little House on the Prairie books, which I enjoyed as a child, but I know are very problematic now as an adult. Mm-hmm. And it's a story of white native born Americans settling the prairie, and they don't really treat Native Americans well at all, and or black Americans, and hardly even mention that they were there, but they were there. Mm-hmm. And so the story of the black bartender in Omaha was one that was really important for me to include, because not only were there cities like Omaha, diverse cities for the time, there were black homesteaders as well. And kind of doubt that anybody went up there to count the casualties in those areas, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very interesting. And there were things, there were perspectives that I had not thought about that were layered into this book. And I found myself wanted to do a deeper dive. You know, I often felt myself wondering what I would have done that day. And I'm not sure. And whenever you read a book like this, if I was that teacher, would I have sent the children home? Would I have kept them there? I think I might have kept them there just because I feel like I could be in charge of them. But I don't know. I really.
But again, you're 15, and like you're 16, and you know, and you've got charges that pupils who are just a year younger than you. I think the idea of controlling the school, that was a really, I think, a challenge for these young girls, and they were so young again because these districts could not pay to have a college educated teacher. So you could just, as like in the Little House on the Prairie books, you could just take an exam and then suddenly bam, you're a school teacher. And you're teaching pupils boys who are bigger than you. Right. You know, so kind of what kind of control did these young girls have over the situation?
Have you seen the PBS piece about
Laura Ingalls Wilder? Not yet. And I'm dying to. It's on my agenda. But I do kind of think of this book as a kind of more adult realistic version of Little House on the Prairie. I love those books again, you know, and certainly were an influence on me as a reader for sure. And I've always wanted to write a story about that time period. It's always been really important to me. But they're a whitewashed version. Even if they're children's books, they were children's books written in the 30s and the 40s, right? Mm-hmm. So they're not the story. They're not the story. We can't take them as a story. But, you know, for a long time, they were the only literature about the people homesteading in that time period. So I do want to see that documentary.
Yeah, it's really good.
My book's a good pairing for that, if somebody...
They're very good pairing for that. I was going to bring that up. And actually, when I wrote about my love of this book on Friday in the newsletter, a couple of readers mentioned David Laskin's book, The Children's Blizzard, which I know you mentioned as a primary research source. Mm-hmm. So I want to get that on people's radar as well. When did you read that? Like how long ago did you read it?
Oh, well, I read that just when I decided to write this novel. I hadn't read it before then. When my editor and I were kind of talking about the next idea, she did kind of say maybe something with children And that made me immediately think of the Children's Blizzard, but it ticked a lot of boxes of what I really wanted to write next. Mm-hmm. So that's when I kind of began researching it in earnest. And of course, the Children's Blizzard, and there's been a little bit of confusion about the title, but that book came out quite a while ago.
And it was 2004.
The Children's Blizzard was the name of the blizzard. So it's not like that just made sense to call my book The Children's Blizzard as well. But his is an excellent nonfiction novel about it, nonfiction book about it, that draws heavily as on some of another book that I read called In All Its Fury, which is that collection of oral histories. Because for years and years and years, decades after the storm, there would be reunions of the survivors. And somebody in the 1930s decided to put all their stories, collected it, and write them down in this kind of self-published little book called In All Its Fury. And the Laskin book, I think, relies an awful lot on that, as I did too. He goes into a lot more detail about the Army Signal Corps. Mm-hmm. And their failings and how that became the National Weather Service. So if you really like the science of it, I really recommend his book, because that was, a novel is a different thing. A novel is a more personal thing, and it concentrates on the people. So I really recommend his novel for that, for sure.
Well, yeah. I like novels like
yours. His nonfiction. Yeah. Mine's a novel. His is nonfiction.
But I like novels like yours that are gateways to us learning more about something, because in reading your book, I really want to know more about this, because it was something that did happen. It had a lot bigger impact on this country and how this country was developed that we don't think about too much. We don't talk about too much. We don't talk about on a daily basis. And I think that sometimes when you go back to look at your roots, you can figure out where the path forward is. And a lot of times we don't do that. We just say, oh, that's what it was. And it's like, well, wait a second. What was happening back then? Are we repeating ourselves now?
One of the aspects of the novel, and there are a lot of themes to this. There's sisters, and there's ordinary people thrust into extraordinary circumstances, and there's survival against the elements, and but a big theme that I really wanted to kind of touch on that I think affects us today is that idea that because of their parents' decisions to cross an ocean and take a chance on a land they didn't know and that had been described to them in a false way, generations and generations of children have been tied to the land. I think it's incredible to think that it's the grandchildren of the children who suffered during the Children's Blizzard that suffered during the Dust Bowl. Mm-hmm. The same part of the country. There's a direct tie to that. And then there's a direct tie to those farming today, and the failure of the family farm and farms being gobbled up by corporations and all that. And it all goes back to these people who first came over to settle a land that had been wrenched away from the people who rightly should have had it. I mean, it's our legacy today, and it's our tragedy today, and it's an immigrant story that, yes, it's different than the immigrant stories that we know today, but yet there are also some similarities. Mm-hmm. I think perhaps one of the reasons why the death toll was undercounted was because these are just immigrants, right? Nobody really cared about them. There's another American Experience documentary called The Blizzard of 1888, but it's not about this blizzard. It's about there a couple months later in March of that year, there was a great devastating blizzard that hit New York and the East Coast. And if you look up Blizzard of 1888, that's the one that will come up, because that's the one that got the most attention, because this one happened out in the boonies. It was mainly immigrants. Nobody really cared. Mm-hmm. And that kind of thing happens today with the media.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because I'd read The Four Winds, which is Kristen Hannah's book, which is set in the Depression. And reading your book, I said, these two really are bookends of what these people's lives. I was really thinking about that, because it's these people move on and it doesn't get better. I mean, it's not like it gets dramatically better overnight. The weather improves, the land improves. It's still something that you're really fighting against the elements every single day. And I think that we live kind of cushy lives these days. I mean, it's kind of like if we're without power for a week, it's like completely like, oh, our lives are completely devastated. Yeah. Really, when you think about what these people were up against every day, that we're moving that whole march to the whole section of the country being developed. And when you're looking at the children, you're right, whose their parents influenced where they ended up living. And what was happening, a lot of them still not speaking the language. And what that must have been as a trial for a student to come home every day to a family where it's the old way, but in this new place.
Right. And I think in the character of Annette, who is the third major character, we see that darker aspect, the poverty. This is a girl, and again, kind of based on one of the real survivors of the, one of the real victims of the storm. Her story is she's born, either not everybody who came over, you know, were a success, right? And there were a lot of people who just kind of remained mired in poverty, ill-educated, and just couldn't get ahead. And I think Annette represents that darker side. This is a girl whose mother sells her, basically, mm-hmm. for the price of a pig, into servitude, into this household where one of the school teachers is boarding. So their stories are very closely linked, and it's this household that is a mess. It is, you know, that the wife is extremely, extremely unhappy being on the prairie, taken away from everything she had known in the city, and blames her husband, and it's just this hotbed. It's just a horrible emotional turmoil that poor little Annette finds herself in. And again, she doesn't know English. Right. And this is the mother won't let her, the mother of the family won't let her speak English at home. But in the schoolrooms, that really was the law. Mm-hmm. They could only speak English. So you had these daughters of immigrants, many of them who had come over as children themselves, you know, teaching what is to them a second language mm-hmm. as the prime, you know, to all these children who go home and speak, you know, Norwegian with their parents. It, yeah, I mean, that's just another layer of how hard this situation, how difficult the situation was that they thrust these very young girls into, and then the pupils themselves.
And you know, it's interesting because too, the teacher was trying to figure out when she was speaking to the students about what you should do, go home or whatever. Are they even understanding what I'm saying? Because right. I'm speaking English. Like, are they right. even understanding this is what I'm telling you to do? And you wonder on that day of the people who died, was it people that just didn't understand what the best advice at the time was on what right. to do?
Right. I'm sure there were some people who, you know, their fate was sad because of that. Yeah.
Was this always the title of the book? Like, I'm sure it was on your manuscript.
It was, but being aware of the fact that there was another book out there, I suggested we could also call it the School Children's Blizzard or the Schoolhouse Blizzard, but everyone really liked the Children's Blizzard. It's, you know, again, it's the name of the actual storm.
Right.
And it's a compelling title and a compelling cover. I love this cover. It's just, like I said, this is a book that will make you feel all the emotions. And
right.
I think this is a chilling cover that yeah. really works. Compelling. Yeah.
I really loved it. I just felt that picks up so much of the emotion of what's going on. They're like questioning faces. They're sad faces.
Yeah.
Worms swirling around. Was this the first cover or was this one you took some time?
It was the first cover and I loved it. I think I had a suggestion about the color of the type for the title. That was it. They right. did a beautiful, perfect job with this. It may have been one of the easiest title cover conversations I've ever had. I just thought Random House did a brilliant job with it. Yeah,
and I did a quick listen of the audio, just a bit, and Cassandra Campbell, I felt, did a really great job of her narration. Was she somebody you picked, or did you just get lucky?
Yeah, I actually haven't gotten the audio books yet, but I saw that there was a link for a sample on some site, so I listened to a little bit. So what happens with the audio, Random House Audio has done the audio books of all, audio versions of all my books, and what they do is they generally send me 3 or 4 actors they have in mind, mm-hmm. Voice artists that they have in mind with some clips of theirs for me to listen to. And then I get to make the decision. And so they sent me Cassandra's with like 2 or 3 other female narrators. And I just felt Cassandra, her voice sounded right.
Yeah.
And you know, just sounded so, not folksy, but you know, it's real and heavy enough for the story in a way, you know, because it's again, it's a very you know, it's a very complicated and in some ways tragic story. And I needed to have someone with that weight in their voice, you know, to do it. So I was very pleased with what I heard so far. So yeah, always very pleased with the audio versions of my books.
Yeah. No, it's, I think she just captured the little bit that I heard. It was like, oh yeah. Boy, that voice is dead on. It's absolutely great.
Yeah.
You know, we recently moved to Williamsburg, Virginia, and I've seen photos of your writing cottage. Have you settled into writing there? Have you settled in yet?
It's a cute, so we have a little, so we lived in Chicago for 25 years, last six of them in the city itself. I loved it. My oldest son is still there, but the pandemic kind of, we were talking earlier that my husband and I now have a big seize the day kind of attitude, right? It causes you to say, where am I? Is this where I want to be? And if it's not, if not now, when do I make this change? And so we made a very big change in the middle of a pandemic. Not sure I recommend it, but we did it. And so we moved from Chicago to Williamsburg, Virginia for a lot of reasons. I'd actually been here about 8 years ago to research a book in Colonial Williamsburg. It's not a book I ended up writing, but I stayed in this particular neighborhood and I just remembered it. And so when we were thinking of where to move, this kind of, I remembered this. We bought our house sight unseen because I had been in this neighborhood. So you never know what writing a book will do for your life. So we moved in September to a house with a beautiful garden, and I'm in the middle of planning a garden for the spring, but it has a nice shed on the back. And at first I thought that might be, it's not even a shed, it's like a foundation. It's a pretty little white house. You know, everything in this area is very colonial looking or very cottagey looking, and it was, but it's too small to be a writing shed. It really is. It looks like it because it's got windows and a nice roof, but it's not, we would have had to like insulate it, and we would have, it really wasn't big enough. So it's now just a garden shed. So this is my new office.
Okay, I love it.
And I have to say, I got the primo office space with the fireplace, and it's got a vaulted ceiling and the beautiful fan windows, and I've got built-in shelves over here. And I could not be happier with this office space, because in Chicago, and we love Chicago, and we're always, my son lives there. I can't wait to go back and visit, but my view was a brick wall. Mm-hmm. At the building mm-hmm. next door, and now I just have a pretty garden out front, and I'm all full of light, and I love it. I'm so excited about my office.
It's so interesting to see. I mean, I had this office here at the house for 25 years, but was only here on Fridays.
Right, right.
And it's like I've changed, and I'm like, oh wow, what can I do there? What can I? And I think that seeing the shed in the back inspired you to buy the house. I'm like, that could be my little. You automatically knew where you could go. Right? It's like, okay, that's all set up, and then you get there and go, wait a second, this would be more like the book than I wanted.
A little bit. It doesn't get quite as cold here as it does. Omaha or Nebraska, but still, it is, you know, in the winter you do need to go. It certainly fueled my imagination, but I kind of knew from the minute we saw that it was not going to be a writing show. I could be, I suppose, but we decided, I can't complain about this office. It's beautiful.
Well, I'm not going to ask what you're working on now, because I know you never like to share in advance, and you like to keep that quiet, but do let me know if there's something that you're working on now.
Yeah, I just started. I had actually made the decision to take 2020 off from writing. And it stemmed from a conversation I had a couple years ago with Nancy Horan, who we met at a writing festival. And in that time, I only had like 5 books out. And she's like, don't you ever want to take a break?
Right.
She said that. I went, yeah, I do. I really do want to take a break. So I had always planned, for a variety of business kind of reasons, that after I turned in the Children's Blizzard, I was going to take a year off from writing. I think I needed it. Like I said, I've published 7 books in 11 years and wrote 2 other books in that exactly. time that I didn't publish. So pretty much I've been writing nonstop. And I think sometimes artists need to recharge. And so I had always planned on doing that. And then it happened during the year of a pandemic, right? And so I couldn't have written this year anyway. Every author I know has had a hard time writing. All I had to do was edits. And that was something that was easy enough to do. And there weren't a lot of them for this book. But to create something during this time period, I don't know that I could have done it. Mm-hmm. So I haven't been working. But I do know what I want to write next. Mm-hmm. I think it might depend on how well this novel does, whether, because it's kind of similar in some ways. So if this novel is very well received, it's kind of a logical follow-up to it. And if it's not well received, I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm going to have to kind of switch gears. I mean, you're always, if you want a career in this, you're always having to kind of try to make little adjustments. You have to love what you write, but you also have to be really aware of what people want to read. And so, but I have an idea. I really want to write it. I've written a synopsis. I've got a few pages in. So once, you know, this stretch of like 2 weeks of back-to-back-to-back-to-back Zoom appearances are done and I can settle down, I that's what I want to do. So I do know. And it is still historical.
But you know, it's interesting because I have quoted that you, I didn't know, I remember there were two books, but that you put a book aside. And I've told authors that, and we've talked about it during interviews, because a lot of times I think that you'd finish the book, but you realize you didn't want to talk about it and work on it again for the next year and a half, or actually 2.5 years.
Could be.
And yeah. I know another author that walked away from a book that just felt it wasn't the right book. And that's such a very big deal. I don't think readers quite understand what you're walking away from at that point. It's away from financially, emotionally. It's, did I spend the right amount of time? Like, I'm throwing something away that I did for such a large amount of time. Very few people do that. And when you're working, people just sit there and say, oh, this didn't work out. We're not going to do it. We're not going to.
I've never had a problem doing that because I never worry about running out of words or stories. Right. And I do think that maybe some authors who feel that they couldn't do that, maybe that's the only book they have in them. And sometimes that's true. But I just feel like I'm a gushing waterfall. Stories and words. And so, and I always learn something, even with the books that don't work. I've learned something about it. I've grown as a writer. So it's not a waste of time at all. So that's why I don't feel torn when I do that. I mean, it's always a disappointment, but I was like the first one to call a halt to, you know, my editor and I had worked on these two books. And I was the first one to say, look, I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, this is the best we can do. I don't know how to make it better. And this is not good enough. I mean, there's a certain amount of pride too. And about what I want to publish. And I don't want to publish direct just to meet a deadline. Yeah, I have never regretted any of those stories, but that's another reason why I thought it was good to take a year off to really, really find the thing that I could passionately get behind. Because to your point, I still get requests and questions about, you know, The Aviator's Wife or The Swans of Fifth Avenue. So years after those books came out, I'm still talking about them. So you do really have to love the thing that you've written. You can't be weary of it. And that's where I felt with those two books. It's like, if I see these books one more time, I am going to pull my hair out. And that was when I realized, oh, well then, I can't expect this to work, you know? And so like The Children's Blizzard, I feel like I could talk and talk and talk about for years to come. And I really needed to take that year off to be able to find that next one.
Yeah. I have to tell you that, okay, if they're waiting for success, I'm predicting yes. I mean, I'll tell you a story. I absolutely love this book. I've loved all of your books. They're all very different as well.
Yeah. And I never know if that's a good thing or a bad thing as a writer. Like I said, I never want to write the same book twice. So that's why.
You can find a new audience that then will go back and read the other books. I think it's new people all the time instead of this is what she always does. But I just felt that this book, the character setting, the news story that was behind it, the story of migration that I had not paid enough attention to. I mean, obviously there are things I loved in history class, but that was a long time ago. And the perspective, I just think you knocked it out of the ballpark. So
thank you. I'm very proud of it. I really, really am very proud of this book. Maybe the most proud of this book. I do feel it really pushed me as a writer in a different direction. And I think I made it. I think I did it. So I just love this book. I'm very proud of it. So thank you so much. That means so much to me.
I also think this will be great for book clubs. So anybody's in a book club, and even if, okay, I'm going to say something really crazy here. If you've never been in a book club, this is
here. Who's never been in a book club?
You know, there are a lot of people that have either that, or it's a book club that only lasts for a year. I mean, most book clubs only last a year or two. I mean, let's get real here. You're not in a book club, I would recommend reading this and putting together five or six friends who are also reading it and making it a book club I mean, if it's the one book book club. And I'm a little bit like, let's do something different this year. And instead of trying to figure out where they're going to gather, whose house, who's going to make the cake or blah, 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 let's figure out a book we're going to talk about and let's make this one of them. And that's just something I'm going to go out and say is, book club, let's not overthink these things.
It's a good, great book club book. I mean, I think maybe my last couple of books, maybe were, I'm proud of those books, but maybe weren't the book, kind of a book that a book club could really get into with, you know, and this one's got so many ways. From the most basic, like, what would you have done? Mm-hmm. You know, and from there, you can just get into all sorts of different ways to discuss this. I thank you for that, because I think it's a big meaty book you can really get into.
And there's a discussion guide, correct?
Yes, there is a discussion guide, which I actually think I need to get that up on my website. Oh, shoot.
On readinggroupguides.com as well. So anybody who's thinking about having a discussion will have it up on the site.
And I will right now, as soon as we're done, go check and see if it's on my website. And if not, I'll get it up there. There's so much to do before a book comes out. And I have two more of these today. Thank you for that reminder.
We had time to speak because it was our discussion a year and a half ago was wonderful. And I'm so glad that we got to regroup now. And, you know, you can pencil me in for after the next book. So,
thank you so much, Carol, for everything you do for authors, especially right now when things are really tough for bookstores and authors. And you're the best. And Book Reporter, Reading Group Guides, you guys are the best. So thank you so much for this.
Thank you so much for joining us. And everyone, we look forward to seeing you next time. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from The Children's Blizzard by Melanie Benjamin, narrated by Cassandra Campbell, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Penguin Random House Audio. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To. Thanks to the producer of today's episode, Austin Rue. Thank you to our research assistant, Catherine Koster. And now listen to an audio excerpt from The Children's Blizzard by Melanie Benjamin, narrated by Cassandra Campbell.
The air was on fire. The prairie was burning, snapping and hissing, sparks flying in every direction, propelled by the scorching wind. Sparks falling as thick as snowflakes in winter, burning tiny holes in cloth, stinging exposed skin. Her eyes were dry and scratchy. Her hair had escaped its pins so that it fell down her back, and when she picked up one of those pins, it was scalding to the touch. Everything was hot to the touch. Even the wet gunny sacks they were using to beat out the flames were sizzling. When Reina glanced back at the house, she saw the dancing, hellish flames reflected in the windows. "To the north," her father called. And she ran on bare legs and bare feet that stung from earth that was a fiery stovetop as she beat out a daring lick of flame that had jumped the firebreak with all her might. Just beyond the hastily plowed ditch, the emerging bluestem grasses hissed. Some exploded. But the fire did not look as if it was going to cross the break.
"Save some of that for the others, Reina," her father called.
And even from that distance, he was at the head of the west break, and through the sooty air she recognized the twinkle in his eyes. Then he turned and pointed south.
"Gerda, go!"
Reina watched her older sister leap toward another vaulting flame, beating it out before it had a chance. It was almost a game, really. A game of chicken. Who would win, the flames or the Olsons? So far, in 10 years of homesteading, the Olsons had come out victorious every time. Gerda smiled triumphantly, waving back at Reina, the outside row of vulnerable wheat only a few inches tall between them. At times like this, when the air was so stifling and smoky, Reina didn't feel quite so small, quite so inconsequential as when the air was clear. On a cool, still early summer morning, the prairie could make her feel like the smallest of insects, trapped in a great dome of endless pale blue sky, the waving grasses undulating just like the sea against an unbroken horizon. But Gerda, Reina knew, never felt this way. Gerda was stronger, bigger. Gerda was untouchable. Even from the prairie fires that flared up regularly in Nebraska, spring and fall. Gerda would know what to do in the face of fire or ice or men. Gerda wasn't here. Raina blinked, gaped at the McGuffey reader in her hand. She wasn't on the prairie. She was in a schoolhouse. Her schoolhouse. The second class was droning the lesson. God made the little birds to sing and flit from tree to tree. 'Tis he who sends them in the spring to sing for you and me. Raina sat straighter, tried to stretch her neck, but it was no use. She was smaller than the biggest boy sitting in the last row of benches. Her pupils, precious minds that were hers to form, or so she'd been told in the letter accompanying her certificate. But the oldest one was 15, only a year younger than she. And the way he looked at her made her shiver, made her think of a well that was so deep the bottom would always remain a mystery. No, it wasn't this boy's eyes that made her think that. This boy's eyes were blue, his gaze was measured, and if there was a wildness in them, only at times, for he was a well-brought-up lad, it was a wildness she believed she could tame. His eyes were chocolate brown and soft with an understanding Raina had never before felt she needed, until she first beheld that fathomless gaze. Gerda would not feel so silly. Gerda would not allow herself to be so understandable. But Gerda was teaching in her own school across the border into Dakota territory, 3 days' travel away, and boarding with a family there. A family not at all like the Pedersons, with whom Raina found herself sharing a roof, food, and air that was becoming too polluted with glances, sighs, and tears. And beds. Beds upstairs, beds downstairs, beds without borders, without walls. Too exposed to those glances and sighs.